WK. Did you the latest scoop from the weather show?
And welcome back to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for May 1999. This is your editor on remote in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention. I understand that they're having a great time back in Lima. It's about 52 degrees, and it's been raining for the last 4 days, and I'm out here suffering right now in 92-degree weather, sunshiny, and yeah, I know you. I know what you're thinking. Shut up, Bobby. Okay, let's get on with this magazine. Before we get into the market scope with Phil Wayne, I'd like to let you know a little bit about the 1999 National Radio Club Convention. Now, some of you are saying that old deja vu. Well, you've heard it before. Well, yeah, you have. 1991 was the last convention in Bridgeport, West Virginia. And a lot of people remember it because it was a fantastic time. It was one of the better conventions we've had, and it's one of those that you remember for years and years, just like the one we just had in San Antonio. It's going to be remembered for years. Well, you're not going to want to miss this one. It's September the 3rd through the 6th, and it's in Bridgeport, West Virginia at the Holiday Inn. Now, it's your chance to begin the DX season this autumn in one of the best places that we can imagine in the whole country. Now, just think. No big city radio stations for miles and miles. No pests. None. That's right. Bridgeport has no AM stations. And Clarksburg, several miles away, has just two stations with night operations. And they're both 1,000 watters. Now, where else can you get away from it all for a terrific weekend in the beautiful hills of West Virginia with new and old friends and just share the hobby? It all starts Friday, September the 3rd. We'll have a reception program in the evening. You won't want to miss when Bill and Brenda Swiger get things rolling for the weekend. Now, Saturday is the time for DXers to get out and around. And the ladies, too, will have a wonderful time in nearby Clarksburg, West Virginia, at the Italian Heritage Day celebration. And those that attended the craft fair and Civil War reenactment when we met in Bridgeport during the 1991 convention are still talking about it. It was a great time. Real fun. Well, I'll tell you what's going to be going on. Friday, if you come on in, it's going to be just a general get-together and meet for a full day of activities. On Saturday and Sunday, we have programs. Sunday morning, we have the annual National Radio Club Test. Lots of fun. And those interested in the DX Audio Service taping of the travelogue can attend the live recording. And John kicks that off in the morning on Sunday, and that will be for the October 1999 edition of the audio service. In between, we have scheduled events, and you can just meet and chat with others. Now, one thing we must mention, it's very important that you let Bill and Brenda Swiger know that you're coming by August the 1st, because they have to give the Holiday Inn a pretty good count of the attendees for the convention. Now, here's the details. Here's the stuff to write down. The hotel is the Holiday Inn at 100 Lodgeville Drive in Bridgeport, West Virginia. Bridgeport is spelled B-R-I-D-G-E-P-O-R-T. And the telephone number for the hotel, and this is important, area 304-842-5411. Room rates are $70.85, including tax for a room with two double beds and no limit mentioned on how many people can be in the room. Reservations must be made by August 13th, 1999 to guarantee this rate. Be sure to call the Bridgeport Holiday Inn direct. Do not go through the 800 number. Call them direct to get that special low rate and tell them that you're with the National Radio Club Convention. Now, what about the convention registration? Well, that too has a discount. It's $35 up to August the 1st, and it includes the Saturday banquet and Sunday breakfast. It also includes all the soda and beer and snacks that you can snarf down during the weekend. Please register by August the 1st so we can have enough hotel rooms reserved. Registration after August the 1st is $40, so you save $5 by getting in your convention registration by August the 1st. After the 1st, it's $40. Your registration should include your name and the name of any guest and a payment for each person that you are registering for the convention. Make the checks payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to Mr. Bill Swiger, S-W-I-G-E-R, at 1 Casey Lane, Bridgeport, West Virginia, 26330. Bill's telephone number, and please call at a sane hour of the day, and prepaid calls, please, to area 304-842-4635. Auction items should also be sent to this same address. As far as how do you get to Bridgeport, West Virginia, Bridgeport is in the western part of the state. I think Phil Wayne and myself will just be driving down from Lima and Findlay. It's going to be very easy to do. Travel by air. You can fly U.S. Air into Clarksburg and then take a taxi from there to Bridgeport. However, experienced travelers in and out of Bridgeport usually find it just as easy and less expensive to rent a car in Pittsburgh, which is 2 hours away, or Columbus, 3 hours away, and just drive into Bridgeport. By bus, Greyhound has daily service from Baltimore, Charleston, Columbus, Pittsburgh, and Washington. And unfortunately, on the train transportation, there is no train transportation to Bridgeport available. So there's the details on the National Radio Club Convention. I hope to see all of you there for the convention. I think we'll have a real good time. And one little piece of information that you might want to just tuck away for the day that you show up there in Bridgeport. Turn on your radio. Check the AM dial. See if you find the newest station in Bridgeport. And on the FM dial, too. I think some of our old members know what we're talking about. Anyway, let's get on with the Market Scope. Here he is. Here's Phil Wayne.
DXAS. With better variety and less static.
IDX Audio Service members and those of you with nickels in hand waiting for a pull on the slot machine, this is Market Scope. I'm Phil Wayne. On this edition of the Market Scope, we're going to take one more look at April Fool's Radio, courtesy of Mark Durenberger. So sit back and enjoy some clips from the past. The next month, we'll get back to more serious stuff.
And Central Minnesota's number one radio station with the number one music that you like to listen to, found right here every single day on KASM Radio. And what do we have here? All right, let's bring our secretary out, see if she's in singing voice tonight. Oh, yes, she is in good voice again. Our weather forecast for tonight calls for clear to partly cloudy. Overnight lows tonight, middle 50s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies, highs in the upper 80s. 78 degrees our temperature, winds northerly at 3 miles per hour. Barometric pressure is falling at 30.17 inches. That's weather.
M. Someplace special on your radio dial. 1150 Albany, Minnesota.
A special place for special people, especially people like you.
This is Lanny Charles, 3 miles east of Albany. We'll salvage an old 52. Sunday, July the 28th, is a big church picnic in St. Wendell. There's free parking and a band will play. Chicken dinner will be served, and you don't have to wear a Sunday suit for the picnic. You must bring money. There will be no sneaking in for the chicken dinner. Also, Father Sauer will be there to speak about the St. Francis Church picnic, which is the last Sunday in August. Every clothes store should have clothes business, so if you have extra money, shop at another store. If you're short of money, shop here. Shoes, clothes, kids, school clothes, as always, were cheaper. Got a letter from a lady in Deep River Falls, and she writes, "How are things in Stearns County? Things here are so tough, the dogs are running away to Canada. The people singing in church can't sing loud anymore. The cops aren't giving tickets anymore. They can't train anyone with money. Is it better in Stearns County? Do you think we should all move your way?" Well, no, Stearns County is still in Minnesota.
Zebedola's Parish at Albany invites one and all of their annual Cellar Festival Sunday, August 4th, beginning at 10 a.m. It's a polka mass with Bob Brebby. At 11 a.m., they'll start serving a chicken and ham dinner with great homemade pies and takeout orders available. Over 50 beautiful, fancy homemade quilts will be auctioned off at 2:45. Plus, there's excitement for the whole family with a country store, games, a cakewalk, fancy works and crafts, cane toss, refreshments, and lunch. Live music, too, from Laverne and the Starlights and the Ron Shea Band. Enjoy yourself Sunday, August 4th, the annual Summer Festival at Zebedola Church in Albany. Here's music coming your way from Christy Hengel and his concertina. By the way, the request lines are open, 845-2184, if there's something you'd like to hear.
All right, two more cuts. One is going to be the a guy named Clyde Wyvoda, the pleasant peasant who was on Sundays doing the news in his own style. And then you'll hear the KASM station builder.
Anybody under 18... to be not allowed to drive a car after sunset unless they are supervised by an adult who is fully qualified to drive. Now, you know when the basketball ends in December, it's darker than the dickens outside. Or even when practice begins, it's darker than the dickens outside. But the Center for Disease Control in Washington, D.C., where all those smart turkeys live, you know, that spend all your money, billions and billions and trillions of dollars, well, they're telling you young kids, you're smart enough to die in Haiti, in Korea, or any doggone other place that we select, but you're too dumb to drive a car. Tell me about it. When you're 17, you're smart enough to shoot a missile. You're smart enough to drink a beer. That's the way I feel about it, because I was under 21 once, and I was in a war, and I won the Battle of Okinawa when I was only 18 years old. Do you know that? I am a war hero. Which gets me to Paul Wellstone. I think he's kind of dippy. That's only my opinion. So don't get mad at me, because that's only an opinion. They want to expose everything the military ever does to find out how things work. Supposing you are a soldier on the front line, or a sailor aboard a ship, or an Air Force guy in an airplane someplace. And the United States government, out of fear of putting anybody that's a so-called quiet civilian right now in any kind of jeopardy, that we better not try it, because you know what? It might hurt them. Get into a foxhole sometime and you'll know what it feels like. Another thing I like about our United States military. I'm in a foxhole. Just picture this. I'm in a foxhole and the enemy is shooting at me. And then a guy or gal next to me in a foxhole says, as I'm about to light a cigarette, because I'm nervous as the dickens, because those are real bullets, and says, "Now, I don't care what Carl on the other side is doing, but I don't want you to smoke, otherwise I'm turning you into our company commander, and by God, when this war is over, you're going to stand a court-martial." That's what we've come to. I think our society is very close to becoming sicker than I am. Well, I always say that. If you think Rush Limbaugh is uninformed and stupid, I can prove that I am. Well, you can't avoid war, because right now they're threatening everybody against... Well, we're threatening everybody, so if you're a young guy under 20... Well, I'd say under 39. Get yourself a wife and 15 kids and 180 acres of land and become essential.
And finally, the mighty station builder.
Boy, town. The only song I ever sang was born in a chasm town. Going down to Ralston to find a drummer gal. She said her name was Joyce, and now she's in the band. Born in a chasm town, boy, born in a chasm town. The only song I ever sang was born in a chasm town. Now my name is Jerry, I come from Flintburg town. I play the concertina with the finest band around. Born in a chasm town, boy, born in a chasm town. The only song I ever sang was born in a chasm town.
Little music for you, four over there in St. Francis, Minnesota this evening. That's called the Chasm Polka by the Jolly Fisherman right here on Chasmland Radio. Great to have you with us tonight.
That's it for this edition of Market Scope. I got a bunch of tapes waiting in the wings, so unless you have something real interesting to show off, we should be good till about the end of the year. Now, if you need to get in touch with me, my address is Phil Wayne, 135 and 1/2 Midland Avenue, Findlay, Ohio, 45840. Or you can email me at phil@nrcdxas.org. That's phil@nrcdxas.org. For Market Scope, I'm Phil Wayne. Now, while I lose a few quarters in the Deuces High poker machine, let's check out what you have to say with amusings to the members. Hey, excuse me, can I get change for a 50?
The DX Audio Service.
Oh, sorry for the profanity.
There's nothing else quite like it.
Mark Marino, March 24th, a little after 9 p.m. at night. We're getting music on 1270. Apparently, whatever it used to be was WWCA, but I don't have an ID yet. But I just thought I'd call it in because it's the first time I've heard actual programming on this station that really sounds like it's going to amount to something. In about 4 years, they were running the weather service for, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months with no idea at all, hour after hour, day after day, and now they're running Spanish. It sounds like it's off a satellite, but it sounds like they've tuned up the audio to make it sound decent, but what it is and where it's from and who it is, we'll have to find out later. But if anybody gets 1270 in Spanish, it may be from Gary.
This is Tim Hendel in Huntsville. First of all, Fred, the worst radio station, I think, has to go to WIMA in Lima. That's not just inexperience, that's shoddy workmanship, and it's a shame to see a mainline, full-service radio station go that way, isn't it? I would like to tell you about a rather different talk show, thanks to Glenn Hauser of World of Radio for this tip. WGN, of course, 720 in Chicago, has a talk show at 9 p.m., which is actually a civilized, decent talk show. Now, I'm not much of a talk show fan, but here I'm not talking liberal or conservative. I'm talking decent and civilized and truly conversational as opposed to yelling and screaming and in-your-face invective, which we hear on so much talk radio. I keep forgetting to listen to this show, so I've only heard it a couple of times. Nevertheless, I recommend it. WGN, 9 p.m. On Mark Durenberger's travelogue, speaking of talk shows of a totally different type, on the Las Vegas station on 840, they said, talk to Bob Grant from 3 to 6 a.m. Well, I thought Bob Grant was the very irascible, in-your-faced local talk host on WOR in the New York City afternoons. So what's happening? Does Bob Grant do another syndicated talk show which he feeds out to the networks, or is this a different Bob Grant?
Hi, Fred and DXers. This is the one and only Victor speaking to you from the Schmidt House in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland. Today is April 2nd. Number one, I figured out WYRE's format. Monday through Friday, they play Country Gold. On Saturday, they play R&B, and on Sunday, they play Big Band. That's WYRE 810 on the dial. There has been a format change. I noticed it over the last two or three weeks. 540 WDN or DMV, Pocomoke City, Maryland, which is about 30 miles south of Salisbury on the eastern shore. They were classic rock. They are now gospel.
Greetings, audio service members. Marty Rimpaugh here on the 3rd of April. And on March 29th, 1650 and 1260 in Southern California began simulcasting the AM-only format, and 1650's call is now KGXL. I know, Fred, in a resubscription note I said that the call was KKGL, but it's KGXL, and I thought I heard them say KGXL Torrance at the top of the hour. So 1650 and 1260 are now simulcasting AM only. I guess KVTR traffic radio didn't work out. Happy DX.
Hi, DXers and Fred. This is the one and only Victor speaking to you from the Schmidt House in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland. Today is April 11th. I just noticed that WBZS, Business Radio 730 in Alexandria, Virginia, has been silent, I guess, for the last 3 or 4 days. I don't know what their status is, but maybe another member in the D.C. area can find out.
Hey, this is Audrey Levine in New York City. I have a couple of things to tell you about stations in Long Island, which is adjacent. On the AM dial, WHLI, which used to be 1100, is now WHLI 1100 and 740. The other thing is that WGBB 1240, which I grew up with when I lived on Long Island, is no longer playing the music of the times or anything. It's the times that I was on Long Island, I checked it. One day it was Chinese, another day it was Spanish, another day it was a strange ball game. Very strange. I'm still looking for air checks from the New England area, but now I need to have some air checks from Montana, Wyoming, any of those Midwestern or Western states, Utah. Those are the three states I have no air checks from. Okay, so I'm looking forward to hearing from anyone with air checks from those areas. My phone number again is 212-614-8764, address 451 East 14th Street, apartment 3A, New York, New York, 10009. Hope everyone had a happy holiday. 73s.
Hello, friends. Ken Onischuk here in Joliet, Illinois. From Robert Feeder's column on Wednesday, August 3/31. Today is Sunday, April 18th. It's the end of another era with the death of the Mutual Broadcasting Systems News after 65 years. Affiliates will be offered similar hourly newscasts and services for another broadcast service. It's part of cost-cutting support by parent Westwood One. I've been doing some taping of Mutual Broadcasting News on a couple local stations, 930 WAUR, 1280 WBIG, and I don't know if we'll miss it or what, but I know there's other news out there. But that's it for now. Bye-bye.
Hello, this is Debbie Caldback from Des Moines, Iowa. It's sure nice to be getting the magazine again. And KXTK 940 in Des Moines has once again changed formats as of February 1st. They went back to their oldest format. However, they did keep I Miss in the Morning, and they do have some sports casts. I can update you on that later. The Art Bell Show moved from KXTK 940 to 1350 KRNT on the overnights now. We now have a 1210 station, which is an city informational radio station for Urbandale, Iowa. I have not catched the call letters. They are about 10 miles from me, but they don't come in. I can't get them in very well. Good DX, everybody.
Hi, this is Rusty Curry in Springfield, Oregon. I've got a couple of questions. First, I hear that you have a database, a radio log on floppy disk, and I would like to know basically how to order, what the cost is, and whether both AM and FM are included. And also, I hear that you sell back issues of DXAS, and I was wondering, I would like especially some band scans from various places. That's all for now. Thanks.
And that's our musings to the members on this edition of the DX Audio Service. And let's answer Rusty's question with a call to Ken Chatterton at the other end of the country at the Publication Center. Ken's our publication chairperson. And see if he can give us an answer.
Hello?
Hello, Ken. This is Fred at the DX Audio Service.
Hi, Fred.
Just wondering if you could let us know a little bit about some of the specials that you have at the Publication Center.
Well, right now we don't have too awful much. I guess for the audio service, remind you that all of the After Dark series, right from number one on, are available. The AM radio disc on log is available again. Price on that is $6. It covers the frequency, call letters, settings, and faith, power. I think that's about what it covers. It's right up to date at the time it's issued. I guess that's about it.
What about some of the convention tapes? Do we have any of those left?
For last year's convention, yes, we do.
What about back issues? Can subscribers still get a copy of one of the older DX Audio Service magazines?
Yes. I believe those are available right back to the beginning.
And what about the price of those?
They're $3 a piece.
Okay, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay.
And that was Ken Chatterton at the National Radio Club's Publication Center. And if you'd like to get more information on items available from the Publication Center, you can contact Ken at Post Office Box 164, Mansville, that's Mannsville, New York, 13661-0164. Or you can give them a call during a sane hour of the day, usually between 11 o'clock and 8 o'clock at night Eastern Time is acceptable. Prepaid calls, please, to area code 315-387-3583. And now, through the magic of magnetic tape, I'm going from Las Vegas back to our studios in Lima, Ohio, for a contest.
More power to you. This is the DX Audio Service.
This month's band scan is about AM radio towers and why they're the height they are. A lot of us, I guess most of us, spend a lot of time recording station signals. But we thought for a change of pace, it might be kind of interesting to spend a few minutes learning some basics about AM towers and why some stations just seem to sound better and reach out better than others. We're very fortunate to be able to go right to the well for this information. We're sitting here with Augie Prestolt, who has been a broadcast engineer for more than half a century. You built an awful lot of radio stations and redesigned and modified, updated, gave them power increases.
Screwed up?
I don't think so. I don't think
not
you...
Not very many, I don't think.
You know, for the 40 years I've been driving by radio towers, I've never seen any two the same height. I know that's because the station's frequency has a lot to do with the tower length, but there are other factors at play as well, and there are non-standard antennas out there, and it seems as though they're different from site to site and station to station. One of the most intriguing to me is the so-called Franklin antenna, the extra tall variation.
Well, a Franklin is a misnomer to start with. The concept is trying to get more radiation efficiency per watt from the antenna than by simple antennas.
By simple antenna, I guess you mean the so-called shorter towers, like the common quarter-wave antenna fed at the base. I'd like to come back to the Franklin in a bit, because I want to know how they work and if they're worth the cost. But first, and for a moment, let's talk about the invisible part of the antenna, the critical ground system, which, if I understand correctly, you have to consider as a very key element when you're designing AM antennas, correct?
Well, yes. Half of your world is the behavior of the ground. What happens up in the angle above the ground is controlled by the angle below the ground, too. So you have to always think of it as a full space thing with two feed points.
Can you consider it a mirror
in an ideal world or a theoretical
yes,
world?
Yes, that's what we do.
Okay, so the above the ground is mirrored by what's in the ground.
We assume that the ground is a perfect mirror. That's the theory upon which they work. How close they work to the way you want them to is how good you make the ground. That's why you spend all the time with a plow and wires and bury them.
Well, we know the typical ground system consists of equally spaced copper wires or copper-clad steel, and it's usually trenched in from the tower base out to at least the distance that the tower is high. So a 300-foot tower would have wires 300 feet out buried in the ground. There's usually 120 of those guys put down in a circle.
Yeah.
Presumably, this is how you get the mirror effect you were talking about. The buried copper electrically mimics the steel in the air, I guess. Let's just take a mom-and-pop tower, which is sticking up out of the ground, and it has these radials buried, and who knows what's going on. You have to reestablish that virtual tower beneath the ground that we
were
talking about?
Well, those radials do a lot of it. That's what they're for.
But let's say it's in dry sand, and they're not really doing much.
Well, if they aren't very long.
Or they aren't very long.
If they're too short.
Right. Now you got a problem.
Now you have a problem. You have an antenna working against half of nothing.
So you've only got a half of an antenna. The part of the antenna that I visualize as being in the ground is not there.
That's right.
Yeah.
We don't have any one-terminal antennas. There is no such thing.
If you don't have a two-terminal load, the electric current can't flow anywhere. So it'd be like hooking a battery to one side of a lamp and not connecting the other side. So I think from the perspective of the transmitter, looking at an antenna, it seems fairly basic that one side of the current loop is in the ground and the other side's in the tower.
Yeah.
And I guess given that we know the desirable signal is the so-called ground wave, which comes at us directly along the Earth, what other reasons are there for minimizing the stuff going up to bump into the airplanes?
It wastes energy. It's not useful stuff, and it's harmful because it takes longer to go up and come down than it does to go the short way.
That skywave signal and the groundwave signal may not complement each other.
If one of them is changing, you get a fading condition going on.
And that can be within sight of the tower, can't it, on some stations?
Yes, it can. Yeah. Yes, it can.
Well, the next time we sit down, I'd like to talk with you further about all the interference mechanisms that make up the distortion zone that we were talking about. Because I'm sitting here with that image stuck in my mind. I can remember instances where I could see the antenna and hear the skywave from it interfering with the ground wave. Let's talk for a minute about taller towers, and I want to get back to the Franklin, because that antenna, it really intrigues me. Again, we need to recall that tower height is related to the station wavelength. The wavelength, of course, is inversely related to the station's frequency, which means, in a practical sense, that the low end of the dial, stations need more steel.
Yeah.
The fact is, however, that in the AM broadcast band, a full wavelength antenna is almost a practical impossibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
That would just be a monster. But the Franklin antenna gets close, doesn't it?
Yeah. Basically, a Franklin is one which has two half waves stacked on top of each other. The image is two half waves then, too. That's really the Franklin antenna. Some approximate it.
When you say some approximate it, I assume you're talking about people who use antennas that are broken up by insulators partway up and that may not be fed at the base of the tower?
Yeah. The term Franklin for antennas in medium wave has been, should we say, bastardized, because everybody who has a sectionalized antenna calls it a Franklin.
And when you say sectionalized, again, for our listeners, you're talking about an antenna that is not fed from the bottom.
There is a feed available on the bottom, and there is a feed available partway up.
Right.
It is in two insulated sections with respect to each other, and you must feed both points.
So there's a clue I can watch for, I guess, when I drive by a tower. Look for insulators partway or halfway up the tower.
That's the basic sectionalized antenna.
And that does not make it a Franklin.
That of itself doesn't make a Franklin. If the lengths are exactly right and the feed system is right, then it is a Franklin.
The Franklin antenna, as you explained it, is actually, again, I'm going to oversimplify this, is one antenna on top of another, and it gets to be a very long piece of steel
at
any frequency. And that's one of the problems, I guess there are several, but that's one of the reasons you don't see many of those Franklin antennas. Even if you could make them work correctly, you're talking about putting up an incredible amount of
iron. We only get long enough to use two elements.
Right.
We never make three because of the physical size.
Right. From a practical standpoint, at KFI's frequency, 5/8 of a wavelength at 640 is already a pretty long piece
of
iron.
That's a long ways to go.
Yep. And if you were to put another one on top of that, you'd be...
Which county are you using?
Yes, you'd have an airplane bumper, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Augie, us serious students of how this is done are aware that there seems to be an optimum trade-off between tower length for a given frequency and the cost for a lot of steel. Even if you could get FAA clearance for a super tall tower, it may not be the right solution.
Yeah.
And you're one of the folks who has done a lot of theoretical analysis, and you and your compatriots have pretty much proven that an antenna that's 5/8 of a wavelength long may be that optimum length, assuming the ground system is okay?
It turns out that if we make an antenna 5/8 of a wavelength in height, you get maximum gain without the excessive high-angle stuff.
So now you've got the most signal going where you want it, out directly
right.
out from the tower along the ground. So if I'm listening to you correctly, you can make a tower too long.
Yeah.
As a practical matter, the engineering folks like you found through practical use and theory that 5/8 represented an ideal combination of cost and performance, and 5/8 was about the limit.
Well,
even.
It
you couldn't go much longer.
Is the sort of optimum between reducing the high angle radiation, and if it's this way, it comes in pretty damn close to your service area
with a good solid ground wave.
Yeah.
Before we get off the tower subject, I wanted to ask you about a trick I've seen used on some towers I've driven by. And I don't know if this is a valid observation, but it seems to be used more on shorter towers. It's what the techies call top-loading an antenna, I guess, using a top hat. And what you usually see on a broadcast tower is some contrivance made of metal or wire at the top of the towers. What's that all about?
We have an antenna that's, let's say, a quarter wavelength high.
So on a given frequency, it's a certain length.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, if we put a big disc on top of that, we disturb the current distribution because current, which was going up here and having to turn around and come back down when it found nothing there, now can go out and fill up all of this area with the top hat.
So this is a piece of metal that's on top of the antenna.
Okay. Yeah.
So the current, instead of stopping at the top, goes out on this disc. Okay.
All right. Now, each of those radial directions cancel with each other straight up. The current comes up here and spreads out and doesn't do you any harm for high angle work. But what it does do is say, oh, gee, I think the tower's so much longer. If you start out with a quarter wavelength tower and put a hat on it, you can make it a 3/8 wavelength tower in terms of current distribution.
So where you're likely to see those then might be in a place where the FAA or local zoning doesn't allow a guy to go as tall as he would like to go.
Or he
can't afford the extra
steel.
Or
his money, his pocketbook isn't big
sure.
enough to afford it.
So the top hat then for our listeners is something that actually electrically makes the tower longer than it really
yes.
is.
Now, it can consist of just a single umbrella, or a section of the guy cables coming back down at a 45-degree angle, for example.
So if I'm driving by then and I look carefully at the guy wires up there, and it's obvious they're not insulated from the tower. They come down, and then there might be a loop around them connecting
there,
them all together.
Might be, yeah.
That could be an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
They don't even need the loop around them. That makes mechanical construction a little bit dangerous and difficult, but
mm-hmm.
it can be done, and it has been done. Now, if in addition that doesn't make it long enough for you, you feed it some other place, you get the current distribution more nearly uniform under the thing. Suppose it's a 528-foot tower. We take guy cables at about 45-degree angle from the top, and they'll take them out 150 feet. And we go back to this tower, and we say, well, let's also sectionalize this tower at about the 480-foot level, put an insulator in. Now we have a tower, we can feed it here, and it has this capacity hat, makes this part of the tower think it's that much longer.
Right.
So we get the current distribution of a longer tower for this lower portion. High Island, for example, is 528 feet high, has top loading in the guys, and the sectionalized part way up and has an impedance so that we try to get distribution that minimizes the fading and maximizes the horizontal ground. 660 and 880.
And that would be WFAN and WCBS in New York, wouldn't it? And in fact, WFAN was WNBC when you built that tower, where it looks like you used both tricks to get a longer effective tower length in a location where tower height must be an issue. Speaking of which, you were there when an airplane hit that tower, and in an upcoming After Dark series, you and I will have a chance to talk about that. But before we go, one more question on tower geometry, if I might. There are folks out there who think the size of the tower, the face size, the width, if you will, the physical width of a tower, has something to do with its performance.
That is one of the subjects in my paper yet to be written. I have reason to believe I backed into something. You remember way back in the early days, the guys were trying to get more capacitance in antennas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, capacitance is an interesting part of this. The bigger the diameter,
the bigger the more capacitance, yeah.
And how this affects it, I am not sure. I think more capacitance is desirable.
And more time with you is desirable as well, Augie. But the electronic warden on Fred Volbe's console is waving at us to get out of the way for now. So we get a chance to welcome you back another day, and we'll come back with a full-length interview on an After Dark show to talk about the stations you built and rebuilt at CBS. Besides, I think I've kind of sucked you dry for a while. Maybe boil the broth until the pot is empty.
Let it simmer for a while and see what else you can find to pump out of the system.
Wit and a turn of phrase from Augie Prestel, professional engineer at home in Nokomis, Florida. Augie was in charge of the CBS radio station's transmitter plants for a long time, and he finished his full-time career as a consultant for the prestigious engineering firm of A.D. Ring & Associates. Now, I mentioned the end of his full-time career because as soon as he started throttling back, he was able to pay more attention to one of his pet projects, an AM antenna that would put the signal where it was supposed to be, along the ground and not in the sky. Well, Augie, I'll tell you, those of us who are DXers hope you never succeed, because it would be a different world for us without SkyWave. This is Mark Dernberger on location. Until next month, good listening, DXers.
Thanks, Mark, and it's great to be back here in Lima, Ohio to finish up the magazine. We'll get to some more news and notes and information, but first let's do a little bit of a contest. This contest is going to be for a prize, which we will disclose on our next edition. Answers must be submitted and here in Lima by June the 15th, so make sure you mail them in plenty of time. Let's go with question number one. How many hours have we presented the DX audio service to you? That is, since we started in April of 1985. Now, this is excluding After Dark and convention tapes. Just the main magazine. Now, a couple of hints. If one side is 44 minutes or 46 minutes, rounded to the nearest quarter, that is 45. For example, the April issue would be called 1.5 hours. Hint number two, we didn't always do 1.5 hour programs. Question number two, what is the difference about this issue? Besides the fact that I was in Las Vegas and not Lima, and the color of the cassette or the label, what is different about this magazine? Give it a listen and see if you notice something which might be different. Question number three, who is Ken Channerton? What does he do? Question number four, where was the 1991 and 1992 National Radio Club conventions? Question number five, what number will the next After Dark issue be? After Dark 7, 8, 9, what do you think it might be? Number 6, during what year or what convention was John Bowker the morning man on a rock and roll radio station, WNRC? And finally, question number 7, who will be this year's convention host? There you go. Have until June the 15th to get your answers to us, and we'll tell you about the prize on the next edition of the DX Audio Service. Now, you're probably wondering what happened down at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention. It was very interesting. I would guess
probably somewhere in the vicinity of 110,000 attendees from all over the world. And it was really interesting to talk with a lot of folks, see what they do in their country and what some of the issues are in broadcasting. Strangely enough, LPFM was not a subject which was covered in a lot of seminars or talks. A lot of the talk with LPFM centered pretty much on the floor between vendors and attendees, just kind of getting together and mulling over some of the questions. And there's a whole bunch of different issues that are being discussed as far as that. Technology and equipment seems to be surviving quite well. A lot of the vendors had new automation systems, ways to archive audio, even some devices which were very much pro-blind as far as their operation. I think the word is finally getting around to some of these manufacturers that they have to make this stuff at least accessible to somebody who's blind. Though I will say that there are a few holdouts that pretty much have just said, well, this is the way it is and we're not going to do anything about it, but I guess that is a marketplace decision on our part to choose who we want to do business with. Some changes from last year. I didn't see any jingle companies, and I think I only spotted one or two programming companies. Which leads me to wonder if anyone in the radio business is actually programming their own radio stations. It seemed like a lot of the displays which were on hand dealt with the satellite issue more than they did local programming. However, given the technology that is out there, it is very simple to put a 3,000 record library into an automation system and actually program your own station without any assistance from the outside. Concerns from people that are in the broadcasting business? Well, there's the concern that the big are getting even bigger, and as they get bigger, they're losing sight of what is in the broadcasting industry and who they are actually servicing. And there seems to be an obvious reluctance by a lot of folks who work for these bigger companies to say anything. However, I did find a lot of folks that said privately that they don't like what's going on. I also heard several issues brought up regarding the new EAS system and whether or not it works. And pretty much the discussion on that issue focused on whether or not the company who owned the radio station that had the equipment actually took it serious. Apparently there's a lot of different ways you can configure the equipment, and depending on how you do that, it either works or it does not work. Oh, and finally, another thought on the LPFM issue. It's probably no surprise that the National Association of Broadcasters is not backing LPFM, nor is some members of Congress who see it as a necessary evil. However, I have to wonder, after reading a letter from one congressman, if it is a fact of a necessary evil or perhaps making the wrong people mad that he needs in his camp. Well, that's about it from Las Vegas. I wish I would win the lottery or something where I could take all the DX Audio Service members with me. There was just so much to see and do, and I know that just everyone would probably just be amazed at what happens at one of these conventions with all the equipment and going to all the different seminars and such. And if anyone has any questions, please feel free to contact me either in email or on the phone or perhaps even on the Musings line. We'll see if we can get some answers. That's it. That's all. There is no more. This magazine is done. I think I'm going to kick back and relax now and get myself together for the next edition of the DX Audio Service. This tape is being mailed on May the 2nd, 1999. We'll see you in 30 days or less with more DX stuff. Remember, get out there and support radio.